3 months into our freshman year at the University of Chicago is when that dashcam video of Laquan McDonald's murder was released. And as you alluded to, both Leslie and I studied computer science and spent a lot of time reflecting on how so much of the technology that was being deployed in our system of policing was designed to make it easier to arrest and to incarcerate. And as young people of color in the technology space, we really wanted to see if we could build software that centers the needs of the communities most directly marginalized by our criminal justice system.
Today on Law Next, a conversation with Devshi Mehrotra. She's the CEO and co-founder of Justice Text, a three-year-old startup that makes it easier for public defenders and criminal cases to review body cam and other video footage. Last week, Justice Text raised a seed financing round of $2.2 million, and Mehrotra and her co-founder, Leslie Jones Dove, have been gaining recognition for their innovative product, including having both been named the FastCase 50 for 2022, having been named by Smithsonian Magazine as among 16 innovators to watch in 2022, and having been named to Forbes 30 Under 30 list for 2021. This is Bob Ambrogi, and you're listening to Law Next, the podcast that features the innovators and entrepreneurs who are driving what's next in law. Before we get to today's conversation, please take a moment to hear about the sponsors whose generosity supports Law Next. Paradigm is building a new standard for legal technology. With multiple industry-leading products all under one roof, Paradigm empowers lawyers across the spectrum of practice areas, geography, and business needs. Made up of the practice management platforms Practice Panther, Meriscase, LolliLaw, and Bill for Time, all of which are fully equipped with native online payments, in addition to the legal accounting software TrustBooks, Paradigm is every law firm's one-stop shop for industry-leading technology. Learn more at joinparadigm.com. Now, on to my conversation with Devshi Mehrotra. Devshi, welcome to Law Next.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
It's great to get a chance to chat with you, and you guys have done so much in a relatively short amount of time, so congratulations on all your success and all you've done.
I appreciate that. It is funny because this is technically my first job out of college. I don't think I had the qualifications to build this company right after graduating, but it's genuinely been such an incredible and fulfilling journey along the way.
Yeah, well, I didn't even mention that in the intro, but the two of you started this, as I understood it, as a project while you were both, I think, still undergraduates at that time, or maybe you were in master's programs at that point. You can tell us about that. But I want to start with, as I understood it, you were inspired to start this company in part by the murder of Laquan McDonald in 2014, where it became evident, thanks to a dash cam video being released I think a year after the murder or so, that showed that Laquan was murdered by a police officer. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that kind of led you to start what you're doing now?
Yeah, definitely. A little bit of context. I grew up in Irvine, California, which is a lovely little suburb in Southern California. And it's also been named the safest city in America well over 12 times in a row. And I think growing up in that environment and then transitioning to the city of Chicago for college was definitely a big change for me, a big point of adjustment. But from the very beginning of my time as an undergrad, I was really, really invested in finding ways to engage with the local community. I recognized that there was a lot that I didn't know, that I didn't understand, but I was also just so blown away and inspired by a lot of the work that community activists were doing in Chicago. 3 months into our freshman year at the University of Chicago is when that dashcam video of Laquan McDonald's murder was released. And as you alluded to, both Leslie and I studied computer science and spent a lot of time reflecting on how so much of the technology that was being deployed in our system of policing was designed to make it easier to arrest and to incarcerate. And as young people of color in the technology space, we really wanted to see if we could build software that centers the needs of the communities most directly marginalized by our criminal justice system. So That was a little bit of the context and the motivation for starting this company ultimately during our senior year.
Yeah. How did you and Leslie know each other at that point?
We actually met on our very first day as undergrads, as part of a pre-orientation program that was actually focused on social justice, community engagement, leadership, all of those types of things. I remember during that first week in Chicago, we would visit local church leaders, local nonprofits, and it was just incredibly inspiring. And it was very cool that that was kind of the beginning of the friendship between me and Leslie. We ended up taking a couple of classes together. We were partners for our databases classes, and ultimately ended up working together on justice techs during our senior year during an entrepreneurship course.
So fast forward to your senior year, how did you come up with this idea? I mean, how did you identify the problem? And what did you see as the problem?
I spent a lot of time as an undergrad just generally familiarizing myself with a lot of work that was taking place around policing reform, around criminal justice reform. One of the books that really left a big impact on me was The New Jim Crow, which was written by Michelle Alexander. And there were a couple of pages in that book that reference the public defender crisis. And for some reason or the other, I couldn't get it out of my head because, you know, I generally thought that to even begin to try and make a difference in the criminal justice space, you had to be the governor of a state or a senator or someone with a lot of power, a lot of access. And I think that was really demoralizing for me as a young person. But when I read those few pages on the public defender crisis, I realized that a lot of the challenges facing public defenders boil down to a lack of efficiency, and technology can't address
and
most
money.
Yeah, exactly. Efficiency and money. And, you know, technology can't address a lot of structural challenges, but it can take incredibly inefficient processes and help to streamline them. So I had a hypothesis that maybe I could try and build something that makes the lives of public defenders easier. And that was kind of how Leslie and I decided to cold call the Cook County Public Defenders.
And what happened then? What did you find out when you did that?
Yeah. To be honest, they really didn't know what to make of us when we initially reached
out.
They were a little confused. What are these two college students want from us? And, you know, what can they actually even offer? But, you know, a couple of attorneys there were kind enough to entertain us for a few meetings. And during that very first conversation, we actually came in with our own idea of how we could help the office, and they quickly shut us down and told us that one of the biggest challenges that they're dealing with from technical standpoint is the influx of audio and video evidence that has really exploded over the past 5 years or so. So this is video being captured from body cams, dash cams, surveillance videos, interrogation videos. And, you know, we quickly realized that this was a massive system that was, to this day, manually sifting through hours and hours of really critical footage. And technology, machine learning, speech recognition could play a really powerful role in helping to address some of those workload challenges. So that was the initial inspiration and genesis for the product. We got started building our initial MVP, which was a very...
This is still in your senior year. You're still a senior.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a valiant effort, but a very ugly prototype that we put in front of the attorneys. But it was genuinely such an exciting experience. And, you know, every couple of weeks, we would make the trek over to the office, get a round of feedback, realize we had a lot of work to do, and go back to campus. So we kept doing that for 6 months and, you know, ultimately got to a point where we had a pretty good product, or at least initial version of the product.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you first walked into that office, you said that when you first walked into the office, you had this idea for how to help them with efficiency. What was that idea that they shot down?
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily that it was a bad idea. I think they just already had systems in place. It was more around helping to streamline communication between public defenders and their attorneys, you know, better like texting, email systems, stuff like that. And they informed us that they already had like pretty good solutions in place for that type of communication.
Yeah. So as you talked to them and they talked about this challenge of dealing with all this video, I mean, did you have to do any further research? Did you talk to public defenders in other offices to validate what you're hearing from them?
Yeah, one of our first mentors in this journey was Bonnie Hoffman, who leads a lot of the public defense training advocacy work at NACDL, the National Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers. So one of our mentors on campus connected us with Bonnie, and she ended up opening a lot of doors for us when it comes to initial offices that piloted the software or just giving us feedback on the idea, validating it, and, you know, opening up her own network for more people who would do some of these like product and user testing sessions with us. So for the first year of development, most of our time and energy was directed towards actually finding public defenders who would tear down our idea or like poke holes in what we had to say and continually give us feedback, because neither Leslie nor I have a JD. We haven't formally studied the practice of law. And so we realized that there were a lot of gaps in our knowledge that could only be addressed by going directly to the source.
Yeah. And you also hadn't studied criminal justice, right? I mean, you were computer science students.
Exactly.
I was confused about that because your FastCase 50 profile says that you studied criminal science. And I thought that's going to be a typo. I've never heard of criminal science. So one thing I have yet to ask you yet in this interview is, and for any the benefit of people listening who don't know, what does Justice Techs do?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a fantastic question. I was kind of referencing this earlier, but over the past 5 to 10 years, there's been massive calls for greater accountability and transparency within our justice system. And one of the primary policy responses to that call for accountability has been to equip police officers with body cameras to record more interrogations as they take place. And, you know, from one perspective, this is a great step in the right direction. But from another step, it creates really serious workload challenges for our under-resourced, understaffed system of public defense across the country. So what Justice Techs does is it's a software platform where attorneys can upload all of this audio and video. We'll automatically transcribe it for them, automatically pull out references to Miranda rights, to weapons, drugs, crimes, and make it easy for attorneys to hone in on the sections of the video that are going to be most relevant for their case. We've also built out other tools around video redaction, video clipping, collaboration, stuff like that. So it's essentially a workflow management tool for video evidence.
Yeah, so you're indexing key segments in the video that are likely to be of importance to the lawyers, but you're also making it all keyword searchable, and they can, I suppose, go through and tag it and index and comment and that sort of thing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So at what point, you talked about the, you know, building this out over the kind of the first year or so after you started working on this. At what point did it occur to you that you've got something more than a school project here?
Great question. I would say, you know, after Leslie and I graduated, I had a master's program waiting for me. I went to China for a year to take part in the Schwarzman Scholars Fellowship Program. Leslie, he worked at JP Morgan for a few months, then he started working at Google full time. And so for both of us, you know, after we graduated, this was a project that we were really excited about, but never really conceived of as being a viable path towards, you know, having a livelihood and being our full-time jobs. But I graduated from my master's program in the summer of 2020. That was a time of, you know, this like national reckoning around racial justice, criminal justice reform because of the murder of George Floyd, among many other things. And I think in that moment, as I was thinking about what my next step was going to be after graduating from my master's, it became clear that there was nothing else that I was meant to be doing in that moment. It was terrifying. I don't have a family of entrepreneurs. I don't think any of my close friends had really gone down this path. I didn't have an existing network of people who had pursued, you know, VC financing. But I just decided one day I'm going to give myself 3 months to try and raise a little bit of money or get accepted into an accelerator program. And if I'm able to do that, then I'm going to not worry about any job applications and just go all in. And yeah, I decided that in like June of 2020. And end of July, we had gotten it accepted into 500 startups. And that was kind of, I never looked back since then.
Yeah. Did you raise any other money at that point as well?
We also raised a little bit of money from Stand Together Ventures Lab. So 500 Startups and Stand Together were the first two institutional investors in Justice Techs. And that gave us the money to hire our first engineer, to have me and Leslie come full time and really just kind of go all in on product development.
Yeah. At that point, when you gave yourself that 3 months, what did you know about starting a business?
I didn't know anything. I truly had no intentions of going down this path. I actually was like considering PhD as a potential route. I had done a lot of internships at Google Brain, Microsoft Research, DeepMind, and applied machine learning, and became really, really passionate about that space. I was also considering, you know, something between tech and government, but never as a startup entrepreneur. And so, funny enough, I would say Twitter became my source of knowledge. I would religiously, you know, follow other startup founders on Twitter, reach out to investors, just cold DM them, and, you know, listen to any podcasts, go through, you know, YAC's Startup School YouTube series. And I just took that as a time of like trying to conquer this learning curve that seemed massive. But I really think I made the most of the resources that I had available. And, you know, 500 Startups acceptance happened because of like cold outreach. I signed up for office hours with Clayton Bryan, who's a venture partner at 500 Startups. And by the end of that office hours, he told us, "Hey, I think I want to continue this conversation further. Let me loop you in with the rest of my team." And I think in so many ways, I think a lot of startup founders can kind of relate to that grittiness and just like being relentless about reaching out in the early days.
So what were the maybe biggest challenges you had to overcome when you were just starting to get this going?
Yeah, I still remember this one meeting that I had where someone asked me what our TAM was, and I had no clue what TAM referenced. And so I was like Googling that on the spot. And it was like, there were many instances where I felt like kind of an outsider, where I felt like I clearly didn't have what it took to succeed in this space. You know, at the end of the day, the only formal experience I had was in software engineering. And so being able to kind of gain that confidence, especially when people said we were too early, you know, our idea wasn't going to be profitable, they wanted more signs of validation, I think that can really get you down. I really just kept pushing. I would say the Duke Law Tech Lab was also one of the first incubator programs that we took part in. And I will never forget like what that experience meant to us. It was a pretty small incubator. It wasn't tied to any sort of investment or anything. But it was a really incredible community of people who, you know, support us to this very day.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about that. You mentioned the profitability question. I mean, you said several investors asked about that. What's the argument when you've got a product that you're selling to an audience of customers that is classically underfunded and under-resourced? How's that a good business investment?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic question. One thing that I do think is important to realize is that government is generally spending a lot of money, even public defender systems, but not always in new technology or new innovative ways of going about things. And so there's a lot of public defender agencies who recognize overwhelming volumes of video and audio as a very real problem. But a lot of the solutions that are being floated around are, you know, hiring more paralegals, bringing on investigators who are solely dedicated to audio and video review. And it's interesting because technology doesn't even come up as a potential solution in a lot of these conversations. And on the prosecutor side as well, there's a lot of grant funding that's now become available for managing body-worn camera pilot programs, dealing with this influx of data and everything. And so we realized that a lot of money is available and is being spent to address this issue, but it's not necessarily being spent in the most efficient or equitable way. You know, from the very beginning, we've been focused on generating revenue. Even when we do small pilot programs with public defenders, we do ask them to pay for it because I think that shows a level of commitment, but it also indicates that they actually find value from the product that we're building. I think it was a very intentional decision on our part to be a for-profit, and we've gotten a lot of success and gotten a lot of public defenders on board who are willing to pay for the value that we're providing.
When Mehrotra and her co-founder created Justice Text while still undergraduates, they never envisioned it as a career, But a few years later, as the country found itself in a national reckoning around racial justice and criminal justice reform, she realized that it was exactly what she was meant to do in that moment. For someone with no background in law or entrepreneurship, it was a terrifying leap of faith. So what has happened since? How did it turn out for these founders and their startup? We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, this word about the sponsors who make this podcast possible. Legal accounting is complex. TrustBooks makes it easy. With intuitive workflows, automatic three-way reconciliations, and dashboards to quickly track trust account cash flow, TrustBooks is the solution every law firm needs to confidently manage its trust accounting without the added headache. Ready to improve your firm's trust accounting process? Visit TrustBooks.com today to learn more. Welcome back to Law Next. As my guest Devshi Mehrotra told us in the first half of the show, her decision to go all in on Justice Text as a business and as a career was terrifying. As we return to that conversation, I ask her about how it has gone since then for her company and for her. We also talk about the $2.2 million seed round the company announced last week and what Mehrotra sees as the future for the company and its product. So 2 years ago, you decided to take this gamble and start this company. As we are recording now, it's a little bit over 2 years since you did that. What's happened in terms of the product? What does the product today look like compared to what you started out with? And then also, what's happened with regard to adoption of the product?
Yeah, 100%. The product has completely transformed since the very early days when it was just me and Leslie kind of tinkering around with it to now when we have a full team of engineers and designers who are truly incredible. I think I kind of referenced the core features of the platform earlier, but it's fully self-service. Anyone can go to our website to start playing around with it. And I think the next iteration of the product is going to be focused on more advanced NLP, expanding support for proprietary formats, advanced video redaction, stuff like that. I would say we have a lot of the basics down when it comes to video tagging, indexing, stuff like that. The adoption has been the most exciting part of this journey overall, actually being able to see the product in action. Some of the offices that have been the earliest adopters of Justice Text are DC's public defenders, referenced as PDS, Harris County's public defender system. We recently rolled it out to every single public defender in the state of Virginia and did a little roadshow to 8 cities across the state. And that was genuinely the most incredible experience to see such a massive system buy into technology that we've used. And we've heard incredible use cases as well of people using it in trial, acquitting folks who have been charged with murder using Justice Text, being able to more effectively communicate with incarcerated clients because of the transcripts that they're quickly generating on our platform. So I would say for me and from my perspective, that's been the most fulfilling part of building this company.
Yeah. Devshi, why limit it to public defenders, or do you limit it to public defenders? I mean, I imagine there are any number of criminal defense lawyers out there who could use this, and for that matter, prosecutors who could use this.
Yeah, we haven't limited it to public defenders. There are, several dozen private criminal defense attorneys who have just learned about Justice Text and have become some of our most active users, actually. A lot of private criminal defense attorneys don't even have paralegals or legal support staff to actually support the work that they're doing. And it was a surprise to us to realize that there's a big use case for our software within their offices. I think we're also open to working with prosecutors who share a similar conviction around advancing justice, around reducing mass incarceration and racial equity. We haven't worked with prosecutors to date, but we recognize that this is a challenge that they're also grappling with. And in many ways, if prosecutors do their job, are able to do their job better, then public defenders will receive this video in a more timely fashion. Hopefully, cases will get dismissed more quickly for people who don't deserve to be charged with a crime. So, yeah, I would say in building this company, we wanted to make a very clear statement that we're prioritizing and centering the needs of public defenders who are so often overlooked in the conversation. But in the future, we're definitely open to working with other stakeholders.
This week, you announced this $2.2 million seed round. Talk about some of the investors in that round. Who's backing you?
Yeah, we have a really, really exciting group of investors that we've brought on for the seed round. Some of the institutional investors include Bloomberg Beta, True Ventures, Higher Ground Labs, Insight.org. And we have other investors like former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, and John Legend, who, you know, bring different types of skill sets to the table. I think our institutional investors, you know, bring expertise around scaling SaaS companies, around hiring, you know, effective talent, all of that. And then folks like Mayor Tubbs, they have a wealth of expertise and connections in the political advocacy space. And to, you know, have a cap table that really reflects the diversity of our mission, I think is really exciting for us.
Pretty sure you are the first legal tech company I've spoken to that has a Grammy-winning artist as an investor. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, John Legend has also been a huge advocate for criminal justice reform, backing progressive prosecutors. And so not only is he just an incredible artist, but incredibly mission-aligned as well.
With this investment, what does that mean now for going forward?
I would say from my perspective, I've been Justice Tech's first salesperson when it comes to cold email outbound, setting up demos, drafting contracts, onboarding people. That whole flow, that was kind of within my wheelhouse. I didn't know what it meant to be an effective salesperson, but I figured it out. But I've definitely gotten to the point where I'm a bottleneck in how much we're able to grow, meet with people, conduct demos, all of that. And so I'm really excited to finally have the resources to grow our team. So we're going to be hiring folks across business development, operations, marketing to really just build the infrastructure around kind of those initial playbooks that I've created for the company. So my main job right now is to be the recruiter for Justice Tech. And so sending cold LinkedIn DMs, having initial conversations, conducting interviews, all of that. From Leslie's perspective, I think he's really excited to double down on product development. We'll be bringing on a product manager pretty soon who can work closely with him, take some of his load off his shoulders, and really double down on that legal NLP and like advanced video analytics bit that I was talking about earlier. And so, yeah, we already have a really great team of engineers, but being able to bring on a few more is definitely going to help us move faster.
I assume the two of you did a lot of the initial engineering. Are you still doing any of the engineering?
Not anymore. It was very funny because when we announced our, Leslie is, but I have not pushed a line of code in many, many months. But yeah, I think we announced our seed round and kind of had a team meeting a couple of days ago. And our first engineer reminded me of the days when he would be reviewing my PRs. And it was really funny because I do feel like I've worn every hat imaginable in building the company. And I'm really excited to now be in a position where I have a good sense of the role that everyone occupies and have a lot of empathy for it. But I really need to kind of step back and let other people take on more and more leadership within the company.
Yeah. Something I meant to ask you a couple moments ago when we were talking about this latest investment round was when you were pitching these investors, was there something in particular you think about your pitch or about what you're doing that stood out at them? I mean, what was most appealing to them about what you're doing?
To be honest, I think it's the level of traction that we have as a very young company. We didn't raise a lot of money for a pre-seed. We raised maybe $350K in dilutive capital. And after raising that amount of money, our only goal was build a product that people like. And because of that, we were able to form partnerships with some of the biggest public defender agencies. We were able to get really solid testimonials from our earliest adopters. And I think the quality of the product really spoke for itself. I think the point at which a lot of people's perception changed or when they really became excited by us is when I would do a product demo during our investor pitches, because I genuinely feel like the skill sets that Leslie and I bring to the table put us at a huge advantage. We are able to build a really solid product before raising millions and millions of dollars. And so I think that really resonated with people. And of course, our mission, I think that's a very quintessential part of the Justice Tech story. So those two things combined probably helped. But I'm also not going to pretend like it was an easy journey. I started having investor conversations in February. And it took me probably 5 months before I was in a position where the round was looking like it's in good shape. It was incredibly stressful, incredibly demoralizing at times. But I also feel like I had a great support system around me to help me keep pushing through.
Yeah. What were the challenges? Were they just getting people to listen, or was it something else?
The biggest one was around market size. I think, you know, selling into government and backing companies that focus on government, focus on legal, is still an anomaly when you think about the venture capital space. And so a lot of venture capital is about pattern matching. You know, am I looking at a company that is similar to another company that has succeeded in the past? And there just aren't a lot of examples of companies like ours who have received this kind of funding. And so I think convincing people of our potential to grow and scale, especially into adjacent markets, was the biggest challenge, but definitely something that we were able to get around.
Well, I think it's a really, you know, it's a really inspiring story for others in the legal tech world. I mean, in a couple of ways. I mean, as you said, you're both founders of color in a field where there are still not a lot of founders of color, and you're in this area of sort of justice tech that, you know, there hasn't been tons of investment in that area yet, and I realize $2.2 million doesn't add up to tons of investment, but I think in a number of ways you show that there are real opportunities for others to pursue justice tech related projects, and to do so, you know, I mean, a little bit of a gamble on your part again. I mean, you didn't have the business experience. You said you'd learn how to sell, all of these things, and make a success of it. So it makes for a really inspiring story, I think, for others in this area.
No, thank you for that. And, you know, there are folks like Jacob Sills, who runs Uptrez, and Kristen from Paladin, who in many ways have
Kristen
been,
Sande.
Yeah, Kristen Sande, who I've looked up to during my own journey, and who have been mentors to me as I struggle.
We all look up to Kristen.
as I struggle to think about how to navigate fundraising or create my pitch deck and stuff like that. So I think for every new generation of entrepreneurs, it's very exciting to hopefully be in a position where you can inspire others to do the same.
Yeah. Looking farther down the road, how do you grow and expand? I mean, do you continue to have this one product and expand its market, or do you verge off into related other kinds of products?
I do think we want to double down on audio and video. Like that is a challenge, how to index it, how to make it searchable, how to make it shareable. That is massive, and its need is only going to get bigger and bigger over time. I do think there's probably adjacent product lines that we could explore in the future, but at least for the next 2 years, I think we're just going to try to become the best company for helping legal professionals deal with their audio and video evidence. After that point, I think it's worth considering if there are other product areas, but we are pretty hyper-focused for now.
Yeah. Well, even just with that hyper-focus, you could move out of criminal law into civil law, into civil cases. I mean, there's a huge need for better ways to analyze and digest and index and all of that video evidence. And I mean, in any number of areas and cases. So I would think there's a lot of opportunities there.
100%.
Something I saw, I was watching another interview you did, and you said something there that you don't want to be just a technology company, or you want to be more than a technology company. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, that's another fantastic question. I wanted to be a lawyer since I was
batting 1,000 on the questions though.
Yeah, no. I'm enjoying this conversation, as you can tell. But I wanted to be a lawyer since I was in middle school. And I think a lot of the work that I did in undergrad when it came to education, when it came to criminal justice work, I didn't necessarily think of it through the lens of technology. I didn't think of it as intersecting with technology in any meaningful way. I thought the work of advocacy, the work of pushing for progressive change was in the realm of lawyers and politicians and, you know, nonprofits and stuff like that. And I think in building justice techs, of course, we're trying to build a cool software product, but we're also trying to change the dialogue around the role public defenders play in the criminal justice system, the need to invest in public defenders, and hopefully work hand in hand with these advocates, these lawyers, these policymakers, and getting that point across. And so I think there's a lot of ways in which you can draw attention to a given cause. You can be a public defender yourself and tell the stories of your clients. You can lead organizations like Gideon's Promise and train the future generation of public defenders. And I think building a technology product is just another way in which hopefully we can contribute to that same goal.
Going back to this, the story here that you were just out of college, you had very little experience in starting a business. You certainly had a lot of computer science experience at that point, but little business experience, little experience starting a business. So now, with the benefit of these last 2 years under your belt, I'm wondering if there is anything you learned about being a founder that's worth sharing with others who are maybe just starting down this road. What was maybe the most important lesson you learned about how to make a go of it?
I would say every couple months there is a new problem, a new crisis, a new area of knowledge that I realize I need to get up to speed on, even though I have zero context going in. I think there's going to be questions around how do you make your first overseas engineering hire? How do you vet that person? How do you even source those candidates? How do you find investors who would be interested? You know, how do you create a compelling pitch deck? Now for me, it's how do I hire people? You know, we're a tiny team of seven right now. How do I actually get top tier talent to be interested in our mission? How do I interview them? So I think every stage of the journey, there's going to be something completely different, completely new that you're going to have to get up to speed on, especially if you're the founder of an organization. And you have to be incredibly resourceful. You can't be afraid to like cold call someone, cold DM someone. You're going to have to kind of sit down, grind it out, listen to a bunch of podcasts and everything. But the coolest thing is that when it comes to scaling startups, there's probably no better place in the world than the US to do that, because there's such a wealth of open source educational resources that are available and accelerator programs, incubators, and general startup communities that you can lean into. I am like a senior, like a serial accelerator participant. I've done 500 startups. I've done Techstars. I've done Duplat Tech Lab, LexisNexis, Launch House. And, you know, after a certain stage of company growth, it is a good idea to kind of migrate out of those. But in the early days, they were completely invaluable. I have found mentors. I found investors. I found friends, fellow founders who have just been so critical in my journey. So yeah, I would say those two things. Just seek out all the resources that are available and then really try to lean into some of those accelerator communities in the startup world.
Well, this is the point in the podcast where I ask you if you have anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked you about, because I always ask so many questions and I'm always afraid that I'm somehow cutting people off from saying something that they wanted, a point they wanted to make or something else they want to say. So any final words on your part, Devshi?
I think from my perspective, we've touched on a lot of what motivates me and drives me. The only thing that I'll say is I am growing the team. And so if anyone listening to this podcast seems like our work or mission resonates with you, please, please reach out, whether on LinkedIn, whether on email. I'm always looking to connect with people who are excited about growing this organization with me.
What are you looking for in particular? Sales, marketing, engineering, all of the above?
Right now, I'm looking for a business development lead. So someone passionate about sales, and then a chief of staff. So someone who's just excited to be in a generalist role and get a lot of like early stage ops experience.
Well, congratulations on this latest raise and congratulations on everything that you've built over the last few years. And it's been a great honor to talk to you today.
Thank you, Bob.
My sincere thanks to Devshi Mehrotra, co-founder and CEO of Justice Text, for sharing her story with us today. What are your thoughts on today's show? Share them by tweeting us at LawNext Podcast. LawNext is produced, engineered, and edited by Populous Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ambrogi. I hope you'll join us again next time for another episode of LawNext.